No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules. And at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. We got a real special show for you tonight. I could say all kinds of things about tonight's guest. I consider him one of my dearest friends in the world, not just in the world of paranormal, but in the whole wide world. He's a fantastic guy. He's only been on the show 3 times, and he kind of gets me grief about it, but that's how you know he is such a good friend of mine, because, like, my dearest friends, you rarely hear them on in All America, because I wouldn't put them through such torture.
Well, yeah, it's been kind of weird because, oh, yeah, I guess you didn't introduce me. Maybe I should shut my mouth until you do.
No. Yeah, well. Ladies, I could go on. This is good because I could ramble here for like several minutes. But I met our tonight's guest, Josh Cutchin, a long time ago. I want to say like 2014, 2015 is when I met him, actually. 2015 at the first Paramania. That's the first time we met.
2016 in Dallas, yeah.
Yeah. All right. No, it was 2015. I don't know.
A Trojan Feast came out in 2015, so I was just starting to dip my toe.
The book was just about to come out. Yeah, the book was just about to come out, so it must have been 2015. That's when I had you on to talk about it. But anyway, see, as we're old friends here, like, I met Josh way back then, and the first book was just about to come out. And another reason, I'll be quite honest, why I haven't had Josh on the show is because I'm fucking incredibly intimidated by his tremendous output of stuff since I first met him. Like, the book was first coming out, a Trojan Feast, and then it's just been like, holy shit, man, this guy, like a rocket. He went off like a fucking rocket, and he produced so much stuff that I can't keep up. I'm a lazy man. So I understand what he's been doing in these tremendous stuff. He's put all these incredible books that are just immensely acclaimed and beloved by so many people, especially Where the Footprints End, a seminal work that he did with Timothy Renner, and Ecology of Souls, which is up to date, is like magnum opus, if you will. It's tremendous, like, ultimate thing. And then he comes out with a fiction book. So I'm incredibly in awe of Joshua Cutchin, and I consider him such a dear friend. And now he's here back on Banal America at last. We can reset the clock. And welcome back, brother.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and it's really special because I remember having been on your show like whatever it was, 2 or 3 times, and then I remember in a Paramania in New Orleans, we're all sitting there in the courtyard, and it's like Banal of America is over, and I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'm never gonna be back on Tim's show again, and now here I am tonight, back on the show, and it's an absolute pleasure. Just to have, I mean, here's the thing. I wouldn't be where I am without a network of people who support me and a network of people who encourage me and, boost me and have kind things to say about me. And, you know, you're part of that constellation of people who have helped me get where I am. So,
happy to do it.
And ditto to everything that you said about, you know, friendship and whatnot. I mean, it's nice to be able to talk to you about anything, really, and I can't say that for a lot of people. So I'm happy to be here, man. It's the BOA revival. I'm here for it. Yeah,
it's gonna be fun. All right, so partly but why kind of this came about is because you have an online course that's starting in a couple of weeks now, so now's the time to sign up, folks, for it. And it's through the Cosmos Institute, and it's on near-death experiences. Again, this is like, what I love about Kutch is that you get the Trojan Feast is like the food. The Brimstone Seat's like the smell. These Are the Nights is like child abductions. Footprints End's fucking Bigfoot paranormal. Then it's like over Ecology of Souls, which is like a mind-bending thrill ride. And so it's like, oh, he bounces or he covers all this stuff. And now he's diving into near-death experiences. And I'm generally, honestly, folks, a skeptic of sort of the online course. But if there's anyone I would take that I would trust, that I would know, would labor over this and produce an incredible, like, experience, would be Josh Cutchin. So I'm like, all right, I want to give him his flowers ahead of time and alert people to this. So we've got this course that's coming up. How did this all come about? And especially sort of you delving into NDEs.
Well, you know, so I tend to, as you alluded to, bounce around from topic to topic, and what that usually entails is I mean, it'll be so much easier to just talk about the same thing over and over again,
Right.
right? But yeah, I tend to, like, roll up my sleeves and be like, okay, I guess I'm learning about the science of smell now, when I did the Brimstone Deceit. And so it's sort of that been that attitude with this sort of material. And I did, go a lot of Ecology of Souls is about the near-death experience and about how a lot of these other different, contact modalities, to borrow a term from Ray Hernandez's Free Organization, a lot of these other instances where people contact intelligences bear the hallmarks of near-death experiences as well, even though there's no trauma associated with them or anything like that. So, but at the same time, I didn't really think of myself as like the near-death guy. Like there's plenty of people who are, get really granular with it. But I was recommended to the organizers of the Cosmos Institute to teach this near-death experience course. And I was recommended by Dr. Jeff Kripal at the at Rice University. And they came to me with the proposal, and I was kind of like, ah, is that my thing? But the more I thought about it, I'm like, of course it is, because of ecology. So it is structured like it's not going to be a near-death experience course that is super granular. I mean, it's not going to be like, oh, today's class is just on the life review. No, I mean, it's we're going to get through that, and it's also, an advanced level course, so there is a certain amount of familiarity that's expected of students to come into the course with. So it is a 9-week course, 9 90-minute classes, with a Q&A each time. We're going to take a look at basically the class is more or less divided into two halves. The first half is looking at near-death experiences, but again, with my weird perspectives that I bring to it. That first half of the course is going to conclude with a Q&A session with Shirley Black, good friend of mine, probably the most studied near-death experience survivor in the world. She was studied extensively by Dr. Persinger, the pioneer, the God Helmet stuff. To the extent that, like, that Persinger started calling RSPK, the psychokinesis that some near-death experiencers have after their brush with death, he's Persinger started calling it the Miss Black effect. So Shirley is going to be joining us for the last half, so the last class of the first half of the course. And then the second half of the course is really exploring all these connections that I've found so intriguing. Connections that have been made here and there by different researchers, but not really put into dialogue with each other. So you've had people come along over the years and say things like, oh, well, the near-death experience looks like alien abductions, and oh, shamanic initiations look like alien abductions, and fairies look like aliens. But like, what happens when you put all those together? Like, what does that say? So, in a lot of ways, it's a very natural outgrowth of Ecology of Souls, and it's absolutely something that I'm just really thrilled to be involved in. The people behind the scenes are very just warm and knowledgeable and helpful. So it's going to be a really fun experience. It's taking place over 11 weeks because we take 2 weeks off at different points, once for Easter and once for, what is that, Memorial Day. And then but it's so it's 9 classes spread out over 11 weeks, and it's at the Cosmos Institute. And if anybody's interested, they can visit cosmosinstitute.org. That's Cosmos with a K. Cosmos Institute.org. And like I said, it's also going to be fun to interact with folks and, have questions
Yeah,
bounce off
that sounds cool because you develop like a group,
me.
over the course of the 9 weeks. By the end, like you kind of there's a it's not just like a mass tons of people. It's like there's at least some that
Right. I
you have a
mean,
small group.
yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong, we would take 500 people if we could. But I think it's going to be substantially less than that. But there's going to be,
Oh, no.
a chance to have sort of a freewheeling discussion, and I assume a degree of camaraderie that will emerge. And
Exactly. That's the word I was
yeah.
thinking of.
And well, and also it's just going to be nice to like have people talk to me about stuff, because some of the best insights that I've ever stumbled across have come from just having conversations with people. And something else I'm really excited about is, none of my books contain photographs, and none of my books can contain video or audio and stuff like that. So to bring that element into the discussion, as well as stuff like the Q&A with Shirley. I think it's going to be it's almost like a multimedia book. It's kind of what it ends up being. So yeah, I'm really excited about that. The first class begins March 23rd, and enrollment goes up to the day of, and perhaps even a little bit beyond. If anyone cannot make the classes, which are Saturdays from 3 to 4:30 Eastern, all the classes are recorded so that people can go back and listen to them. So yeah, that's what has been occupying a substantial amount of my bandwidth for the past 2 months. It's just really preparing for that and trying to make it the best experience for everyone that it can be.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we were talking about this before we came on the air. It's a very different process. It's kind of like writing a book, but it's like it turned into like a multimedia presentation. So it's in a way, it's interesting because you just did the fiction book. So you're kind of experimenting with different mediums in a way of putting this information out there.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a lot more conversational style. I mean, for better or worse, my stuff has been received as being academic. And just to be a little bit more conversational with people and, you know, throw in the odd joke every now and then. It's not something that I do a ton in my work. So, and yeah, that's part of what I really feel a tug towards this year is just experiencing and expressing this stuff in different ways. It's part of the reason that I did my first novel, Them Old Ways Never Died, is because, you know, I wrote Ecology of Souls, which is still kind of a snapshot of how I view this whole thing. And it's like, well, what the heck do you do? Oh, I can curse. It's been all of America. Yeah. What the fuck do you do? What the fuck do you do after that? And so that was why I did the novel. And this is sort of a different expression of that as well. And, you know, something else I have planned for the remainder of the year is doing a lot more field work. I started dipping my toe into the water with that a little bit more last year. I think I had maybe 4 or 5 different outings. For the most part, with perhaps one exception, they were all duds. But this upcoming year, I've I'm a probationary member of a paranormal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, probationary member of a – I know, right? So I've got a P's and Q's, right? A probationary member of a paranormal investigation group. And, you know, there is a service-based aspect to it because it's, you know, mostly going into people's houses and being like, yes, it's haunted or no, it's not. So, but that's just something that I've been wanting to have a lot more of is that firsthand experience because, yeah. You know, I know you're like me, like you have very strong suspicions that this stuff exists, but the amount of genuinely
personal experiences. Yeah.
Yeah. You can fit inside a thimble, right? You know,
we did go in the Bellwitch cave. That was, did you count that?
So, I don't know, kind of. I mean, it was the nighttime tour, which was kind of cool. No, so let's see. I went on an overnight Bigfoot thing, not far from my parents' home in North Carolina. Maybe it was like 3 things now that I think about it. But the thing that was most interesting to me that happened to me last year was I went out to. I had the good fortune of having extended family that has moved within 45 minutes of Timothy Renner, I absolutely hated to hear about that. So now it's like, yeah, we'll visit anytime. So over Thanksgiving, the family went up there and I dropped off the family and I'm like, bye, I'm going to go hang out with Tim. We were able to go one of the nights that I was there to Site 7, which is one of his research sites where he's had these large shadows that have been seen, a lot of interesting recordings. And one of the things that they get there are these ghost lights. And some of the sightings are super dramatic. I don't know if you're familiar with any of that stuff that he's done, but like the one that I think is perhaps the most interesting is he brought along someone else who accompanied us on this little outing, who saw this like ball of light coming up really close. And this person was convinced that they were just going to go there and they were just going to completely debunk the whole thing. And like this ball of light gets so close that he reaches out to grab it. And as he reaches out to grab it, it winks out of sight. And this individual said that the orb of light was the size of a ping pong ball. Tim, who was standing at a 90-degree angle, said that it just looked like a pinprick of light, which is, I don't know what that means. It's odd and it's weird and I love it, but I don't know what it means. So that's sort of the stuff
that
happens.
That's almost Adam Davies Portal-esque shit. So.
Oh yeah. I mean, this is the kind of place that you would expect. And there's some other stuff, you know, I can't talk about exactly where it is. And not being coy, I'm just trying to be respectful of Timothy's research area. But there's some other stuff around there that would make you go, okay, this is kind of the place where some odd stuff would happen.
Yeah.
So I was sort of on the lookout for ghost lights, and we maybe didn't see any. The one thing that I will say is that I was rounding a bend on our way into Site 7, which I had not had the chance to go to go inside in the past times I've been there. And as we're rounding this bend in the trail, I look to my right at this tree, and there's, you know, a fork in the tree. And I see off in the distance what I presumed was a headlight. I only really saw one moving from about the 4 o'clock position to the 10 o'clock position, not like, you know, straight across.
Yeah.
And over the course of 3 seconds or so, it passed behind some foliage. So, you know, kind of blinked out a couple times, but it looked just like, I was like a headlight, you know, it was just a headlight.
Yeah.
And I mentioned to the guys, and I said, you know, I saw a headlight over there, and they're like, No, you didn't. because if there's a mountain over there, and they're like, we'll take you around that side of Site 7. There's no road to get on the other side of that mountain, on the other side of that ridge. And they said, you know, it was really quiet out there that night in terms of, like, we would have heard an ATV. We would have heard an ATV. So maybe, I mean, that's how half my shit goes, man. It's like, yeah, I have a lot of maybe experiences, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I don't know what you'd have to do to court a real experience. Well, it's funny, when I was talking to Steve Berg way back when we kicked off the revival, you're the subject of where the footprint of sound came up, and we were sort of talking about paranormal Bigfoot, and I was like, I think it never dawned on me till that conversation, but I was like, if the sort of theory that you guys put forward is correct, then that is much cooler for fans of Bigfoot, because that means that I could conjure Bigfoot like in my backyard.
Oh, 100%. I mean,
like,
you know,
it takes away all the limitations where it's like Bigfoot can't be like in
the caloric needs. The caloric needs of a 900-pound primate could never be met in your backyard.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing. And there is no shortage of urban Bigfoot stories. You know, I wouldn't call it, a plethora or anything like that.
Yeah, it's not prevalent, but
you just look a little bit and you can find them. Bigfoot rummaging through a city dumpster, or, you know, there are a couple of parks in Chicago where, like, monkey chatter has been heard, or there are primate footprints, or, you know, there's a very relatively famous sighting in Schiller Woods, which is in, like, sort of really near O'Hare, and it's you know, it's a park that's surrounded by, you know, urban sprawl, and there was a sighting of a guy who was riding a bike, and if memory serves, he prayed the Bigfoot away, you know. So it's double confirmation that this thing, at least sometimes, seems to have sort of a more supernatural source. It does kind of I don't know, I'm going to get kind of fancy here, but it does kind of re-enchant the world in a way, you know, because...
Yeah, that's kind of...
It can happen anywhere you go. Like, you know, it can happen in the park next to your house, no problem, no matter where you are.
Right, exactly, yeah. That's the cool thing. But, yeah, for some reason, it's hard to... It only happens to people when they don't expect it to happen. That's why we kind of, like, get...
Well, right. Like, it only happens, we already have
that sense of wonder about it. So it's like, oh, we don't need... These guys have already bought into this shit. So I don't need to convert them. I need to get these other people who haven't had the experience and started thinking about
right. This. Well, you know, and I've tried this. I've tried, like, swinging the pendulum of belief in all directions before I go out to some spot, you know. So I've tried going out being like, tonight's the night, I'm gonna see something, it's absolutely gonna happen. and I've also tried going out and being like, paranormal's a bunch of bullshit, you know. Like, it's, and I've also tried, like, to to bring that right to the middle and be kind of, you know, zen about it and being like,
yeah,
there, it may happen, it may not. It's all in, you know, God's plan or whatever. And just, it, I keep on getting a dial tone, you know, yeah. just nothing, nothing at all. But, you know, I do think that these things are repeatable to a certain degree. I mean, I'll never forget, I was in a, I think it might have been at one of the Strange Realities. I was with Ren and we were talking about stuff and how I'd, you know, it'd be nice to see a fairy or something at some point. Ren's like, you know, some mushrooms will do that for you. And I'm like, yeah, I'm just too chicken shit to do it, you know. You know, and so I do think that this stuff is, can be conjured to a certain degree.
Yeah, but, for know. Sure. But, yes.
But, you know, but even the stuff that I have, even the stuff that I'm really charitable towards, just doesn't really seem to have good results. In August of 2022, I participated in CE5. Which, you know, you can say what you want to about Greer, but
was this with Greer? Or
no, it was, not with Greer. It was okay. With a different organization.
All very
kind, warm, inviting people. Like it was a great experience.
Of course.
The whole weekend was great.
Most cults are.
But
I have no idea. At all
honestly,
they love bombed you. Love bombed you.
we'll get there because if you'd have seen what I did and what we did, like you would have maybe thought that from a distance. But you know, but you can say what you want to about Greer. But I've talked to and heard stories about and from so many people who have participated in these events that have had odd things happen.
Yeah.
And what's more, what I find really interesting is that it's not always stuff in the sky that comes out after a CE5. Like people will see ghosts or they'll hear a Bigfoot in the woods or something, you know, so it's strange things, you know, a lot of them fall into that sort of ambiguous category that we're talking about. So I showed up for this thing and I'm like, it was across the street from the venue in a cemetery, like perfect setting, right? Great. And like there's like a bowl, one of those bowls that you like take off your shoes and you stand in and they like rub the bowl on the outside and it raises your vibrations. And
okay,
it's a thing. Yeah, like I said, if you've been witnessing from a third party spot, you'd have been like, huh?
Wait, but you get into a bowl?
you take off your bare feet, right? So take off your shoes, take off your socks, you step
and
into
you get
the,
into a bowl.
You step into this big like bronze bowl or something like that. I'm sure that there's some new agers out there who are just absolutely screaming at the at their radios
like,
right
it's
now.
It's called a Bell Holland.
Right. But then they, you know, they wave their things around you and they vibrate the bowl and it's supposed to raise your energies. And of course, you know, I have a what's the best way to put this? I have a give and take, love hate sort of relationship with the new age stuff.
Yes,
you know,
I feel the same way. Yeah. I feel like I'd be one minute I'd be like, this is kind of enchanting, and then the next minute I'd be like, this is fucking stupid. What am I doing in this Bell Holland thing? I want to get out of it.
In my experience with the new age, like I'm super open to it, and I'm super open to it, and I'm super open to it, and then somebody takes it one step too far. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm done here. But anyway,
step into the bowl.
I was super open-minded, super relaxed. Yeah. Like really, okay, I don't know. I don't even know how to raise my vibrations, but I was trying to raise my vibrations too.
Yes.
And we, you know, sit down and we put on some meditative music, and they're talking about our consciousness going out past the sky, past the stratosphere, into the solar system, past that into deep space, and reaching out to the intelligence and contacting it and being warm and inviting and telling it to come back down. And, you know, I did all that and, you know, fuck all happened. But there was, we were encouraged to take photographs, and I definitely did, took a lot of photographs, didn't get anything that I really noticed. But there was a photograph that was taken by someone else, and it was very uncanny when I saw it the next day. You know, this participant was going around showing everyone, like, you know, look at this. And it's this disembodied head from, like, you know, the collarbone up.
Oh,
and it's blue and it's floating. And it's like, it's not like, oh, this might be pareidolia. Like, this is a face. This is completely a face.
Yeah.
And it looks like this, like, Dickensian goblin, right? Like, there's like this, there's like this sort of like cravat or something, and like, you know, these sort of like high forehead and this sort of hair that's almost like a wig. And I was like, oh my goodness,
yes,
like,
powdered wig.
And we're all like, I don't know who that's nobody that was with us. It's, you know, we're all talking and all this stuff. And finally, at some point in the day, the photo gets shared, and someone goes, that's Cheryl. That's her new jacket.
Oh,
and we've been talking this entire time about how hideous this goblin is, you know.
I felt
sorry for her.
Oh my god.
But you know, I don't want to make that sound like I'm downplaying the event, because everyone there was lovely, and it was actually one of my favorite events that I've been invited to.
No, it sounds cool. I mean,
yeah, it was a wonderful setting. We were treated like the speakers were treated like royalty. It was wonderful. But there were some humorous moments to be found from that as well. So
yeah.
So yeah. So how do you follow that up, right?
Yeah, I don't even get on that. So I was on Vince Treewell's show. He asked me about the afterlife and shit, and of course the Ecology of Souls came up. We were kind of talking about the afterlife and whatnot. And I just made the sort of broad point that, and I was thinking about talking to you tonight, I was like, oh, maybe I'll ask Kutch about this. Where it seems like when you die, you must be given some kind of choice of what you want to do. Because like this whole reincarnation, but then there's also, you know, going off to do something else or becoming a ghost. Some people stick around somehow. So it's like I called it like the bureaucracy of the afterlife. There must be some kind of system in place.
Yeah, I heard someone who thought that they were making a brilliant point, and I have plenty of objections to it, which I'll enumerate here, but they thought that they were making a brilliant point by saying, oh, well, reincarnation can't be real because why do we have ghosts then? Like one of these has to be wrong, right? And I think that that is sort of a narrow interpretation of what could be going on. Number one, if you look at a lot of these reincarnative traditions, there are penalties, you know, for not doing what you were sent here for. So perhaps that is the reason why we still have ghosts and we have reincarnation. Similarly, it's operating under the assumption that ghosts are dead people, which is something that I become less convinced of by the year. You know, if you look at stuff like the stone tape theory or, you know, there's an interesting conversation.
For sure, yeah.
Well, there's an interesting conversation to be had about, you know, the fact that like the ghost of Mark Twain appears at like four or five different locations, you know. So is he hopping around or is there something else, some sort of memory that's going on there? Or, you know, one of my favorite examples was that at the Biltmore House in Asheville, North Carolina, people say that they see George Vanderbilt smoking a cigar. And George Vanderbilt never smoked a cigar. He was a teetotaler. He didn't drink or smoke.
Yeah.
So there's something about expectations that plays into this. There's something about, you know, all these different things. So that's the second thing. But then the third thing is that you're also assuming that reincarnation is like this one-to-one thing. And I don't really think that that's the case. We'll put that on pause for a moment. I do think that there's a lot of strong evidence for reincarnation. If you look at the work of Ian Stevenson and Jim Tucker, like some really good research.
Yeah, there seems to be something to it.
Yeah. And of course, you know, you can sort of say, well, these children who have these memories that are very specific to another person's last moments, perhaps they're drawing upon the Akashic record or some sort of store of knowledge or whatever. But, you know,
it's still mystical at that point. Yeah, you're just
it's still mystical at that point. But, you know, the other thing that people say, and they think they sound really smart when they say it, is like, well, if reincarnation is real, why do we have more people on the planet than ever before? And my response to that is, you know, well, how many waves can be on the ocean? You know, an infinite amount. So if you're just dealing with like this just collective pool of soul, which again, for us to have sort of been bagging on the New Age movement, here I am using very New Age terms, but conceptually, I think it makes some sense. If you have this collective pool of soul energy or whatever, each of us are these little, you know, waves on that ocean, I think. And but that also means that the parts of one wave are taken from the parts of a previous wave, but also parts from a different wave, you know. So that's also why you get things like people, you know, seven people saying that they're Napoleon Bonaparte.
Well,
it's because maybe it's different parts of Napoleon in different people, you know.
Right. And also it's like maybe there's more people, maybe whatever's controlling the soul. Like, let's say this, someone could be running my character, and also someone could be running also a character like in India or whatever. You know what
I'm
saying?
Right.
So it's like, no, it's like, you don't. You only need one soul to power several people.
Well,
skeptic.
I mean, well, you know, that's one of the things they say. I mean, I disagree with it, having seen how different my boys have grown up being raised by the same parents under the same rules. But, you know, that's one thing that they sometimes say. I think it might even be a Colin Wilson quote about, you know, identical twins, two bodies, one soul. Because, you know, you get these stories of these identical twins separated at birth who both marry women with the same name or men with the same
Yeah,
name
it's
and
really things
they
like
have
that, yeah.
the same, they go into the same line of work even though they haven't talked to each other. Yeah. So there, I think that you're right. I think that they're also, I think it's a possibility. Let's put it that way. I think it's a possibility that there are multiple strings on the puppeteers
Why
marionette, you
not?
know?
Why? I mean,
Yeah.
that would be my explanation for the thing, for the argument of like why. It's like I can answer your not skeptical. You know, I can answer the absurd question with an equally absurd answer. It's like,
Right,
oh,
but
talking.
so, but I think, you know, going back to my the original sort of thing that I brought to this conversation, like sitting there and saying, well, reincarnation can't be a thing because we have ghosts, just shows you how people, I don't think people engage with this stuff at the level that they could. And sometimes when they do, it's just that pop culture level, that like, you know, consensus opinion level. And it's like, well, if you look into alternative explanations, then you can, you know, sort of find an explanation that works for you know. So yeah, and you do get this, you do get stories in the near-death experience literature of these ultimatums, you know, not only to stay or go, but like, do you want to push the restart button, you know?
Oh, wow.
Stuff like that. There are allusions to stuff like that. So
Interesting.
yeah, and of course, you know, it sort of a narrow data set because we don't have any information from the people who make any choice other than to return.
Right,
But
that's true.
or,
Yeah.
yeah, but you know, but at the same time, you know, there is this whole subset that is studied by near-death experience researchers of pre-birth memories, which, you
Yeah.
know, I'm not saying, I'm not passing a judgment on the authenticity of those, but it you know, they're common enough to not be ignored, and they bleed over into the UFO literature a lot. I mean, that
Pre-birth
was
memories?
pre-birth memories. Yep.
What
Memories
is it?
of being of selecting or being assigned to a family.
Oh, weird.
Oftentimes in these narratives, the people who remember this experience say that they were a ball of light, they were an orb of light.
Oh, wow.
Similarly, you get a lot of stories of near-death experiencers who say, I was a ball of light, you know.
Yeah.
Which has all sorts of implications for the rest of the paranormal, and something I talk about a bit in Ecology of Souls. Yeah, so then these pre-birth memories appear in
That's
the
fascinating.
alien abduction literature too. Yeah, and it's one of the reasons that I wrote Ecology. I mean, there are probably like seven or eight reasons why I wrote Ecology of Souls, but one of them was the fact that like I kept hearing these pre-birth memory stories in regards to
Yeah.
ET, and like, oh, my ET family assigned me to this family on Earth to learn a lesson. And it's like I would hear those and I'd just go,
Yeah.
ah, what do I do with this? And you know, it's not like I have like a religious or an ideological aversion to it. It's just like I think that UFOs are real and I think that UFOs are weird. So how do I fit these into that broader narrative? Like, can it be done? And you know, once you start going down that path, you can start to integrate some of that once you start looking at the connections to death and all this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, these wonderful little illusions in fairy folklore that the fairies would laugh at funerals and cry at births. And it's like, well, it sounds like there's sort of a revolving door, you know, between our
Yeah.
world and whatever world these things occupy. So, yeah, it's a whole rabbit hole of its own.
It's
Yeah.
yeah, the afterlife, man. It's an eerie death, man. It's like the finality of it. It's the ultimate mystery of all these fucking mysteries. It supersedes all the mysteries. UFOs, ghosts, Bigfoot, like it's the ultimate fucking
Yeah, well,
it's got it all wrapped up in it. It's like conspiracy theories and all kinds of shit. It's like
that's what I tell myself when I scold myself for making Ecology of Souls so big. But then I'm like, you know, it's you're dealing with death. Like, there are a lot of different things to
yeah.
consider. And yeah, I you know, I have a lot of different opinions on what that is and what that looks like. I mean, you know, I think about a toddler playing with toys and like, more than anything else, you know, if you told them they were going to be an adult and they had to give up their, I don't know, their Lincoln Logs or whatever, you know, they'd be horrified and they'd hate it and they'd cry and they'd wail. But as an adult, you're like, no, this is, you'll be fine. This is great. Like, this is so much better. You won't even care about that stuff. And I sometimes wonder slash hope that the transition is something like that. Like, you know, it seems so horrible to us, but that's because we just don't have the benefit of perspective.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, the near-death experience stuff is so compelling and quite frankly reassuring. And there are a handful of hills that I will die upon in the paranormal. One of them is, the first one is that psi phenomena is real. I mean, you look at the work of Dean Radin and Daryl Bim and all these people who are like playing by the rules, right? Like, you know, they're doing stuff in laboratories. They're examining, they're illustrating that these have an effect that's over random chance. Like, psi is real. It's just not being acknowledged because of, you know, biases. But the other hill that I'll die on is the near-death experience, because like some of these stories, I mean, man, they have such a, you know, another fancy word, they have such a veridicality to them. They can be proven in a lot of ways. The famous example of the heart attack patient, I believe her name was Martha, and I believe it was in Seattle, who returned back from death and said that, you know, she left her body. And why is there a tennis shoe on the ledge of outside the window of the hospital? And everybody's like, what? And she's like, no, it's a tennis shoe and it looks like this and it's this style and it's this brand and it's this color and it's sitting outside a ledge. And they looked all over the hospital and finally they found that someone, for whatever reason, had put a tennis shoe on a ledge. And it's like, I don't know how you explain that if there's not something to that story. Or, you know, these wonderful stories that I love about people who come back from near-death experiences and saying, like, you know, I met Uncle Bob. And they're like, are you kidding me? Uncle Bob's fine. He's in, you know, he's in Tampa or whatever. And then they're like, in fact, I'm going to call up Uncle Bob, and they don't get an answer. And they find out that Uncle Bob died while the other person died as well. Jesus. It's just, I don't know how you, I mean, I just got chills sort of telling that sort of, well, I mean, I don't know if Uncle Bob and Tampa are the right proper nouns for that story that I just told, but there are stories that are about people gaining intelligence that they have no reason to have access to in the short amount of time that they have during their death. Another good example of that is a story of and this is a little bit less provable, but I think is still compelling, of a man who died and met this other strange, you know, gentleman on the other side that he did not recognize. And it wasn't until his mother died years later that she produced a photograph of his actual biological father, who had been the product of an extramarital affair. And it was an exact match for the guy he had seen. Yeah. You know, but even some of the less dramatic stories or the sillier stories are still, that they can be verified. You know, I would recommend anybody look into the work of Pim Vim Lommel, he's the guy who did the 2001 Lancet study of near-death experiences. And he has an account in one of his books about a gentleman who had, you know, he had gone flatline, and he came back to consciousness and he said, hey, can you get my dentures out of this specific drawer? And while he was dead, like, they had removed, for whatever reason, they had removed his dentures and put them in this drawer that, like, you know, there's no way he would have known. But like, the nurse was like, that's exactly where I put them. And, you know, describing things that people do, or like certain quirks that surgeons have or things that they say. And this is when brain activity is non-existent. And sometimes they even have their eyes and ears covered. So it's not like, you know, they're kind of sneaking a peek or something. So, and you know, there are some people who will dance around it and say, much along the lines of what we were talking about with reincarnation and the Akashic record, they'll say, oh no, the near-death experience survivor wasn't actually out of their body. They were retrocausally, psychically picking up on what happened in the room. And it's like, okay, like, dude, like, maybe it is just what it seems to be, you know? And I'm aware of the irony of me saying that, since I'm not into the extraterrestrial hypothesis, but sometimes I think that elaborate on these things, the more complex you make them, it's like, yeah, maybe it's just exactly as it seems like it is, that an aspect of the human self survives death, at least for a short amount of time, you know.
Now, did you ever look at the case of the lady? She was on Art Bell with one of the near-death experience researchers back in the day. She was a blind woman who had a near-death experience, and then she could see. during the experience. It was a remarkable story.
Not that one specifically, but you hear that a lot. You hear about people who regain their eyesight, having not had their eyesight. There are stories of people who have not been able to hear their entire lives who can hear, or, you know, who can have telepathy. One of the things that seems to make sense in this context is that there's also these stories of 360-degree vision. So it's this idea that somehow your eyes are not the organ through which you're perceiving your surroundings. There's something, you know, some sort of extended consciousness thing. Yeah, I can't even.
That'd be awesome.
It's so wild because, like, you hear those are the two things that I hear in near-death experiences that I can't wrap my head around. Pardon the pun. Are 360-degree vision and colors that aren't colors that we have on Earth.
Yeah, I've heard that kind of thing.
It's like, I can't even imagine that. Like, I can't even.
Yeah, it's like, how is
conceptualize
that?
That
360 vision. Yeah, I'm surprised that like Apple hasn't tried to come out with something like that. Just hearing it, I'm like, that sounds fucking cool. Like that would be neat.
Yeah, it would be super rad.
Disorienting though.
I guess.
Like, which way am I walking? You need to know which way was forward, I suppose.
Well, you're kind of like a consciousness drone at that point. You just sort of...
Yeah, it's like a ball of light. Yeah.
yeah.
You're just a ball of light.
Yep. So the near-death experience literature is just something... And that's part of the reason that prior to Ecology of Souls, I hadn't really made a deep dive. I mean, I was familiar, as we all are, involved in these topics, because you can't help but hear about them. But to me, it's very much the same reason that I'm not super immersed in ghost stories, is because it's like, yeah, ghosts exist. Next question, please. You know, near-death experiences happen. Right. Next question, please. So, yeah. And then once you start really getting granular with some of the things that happen in near-death experiences, you're like, oh, this looks like a lot of other things. And what does that say? You know, what does that say? What does that imply? Yeah.
Now, do you think, this is kind of a kooky question, but I think I talked about this with Rosemary Ellen Guy way back in the day, that maybe, like, I wonder if the government has, we talk about all these things they've done, these sort of, like, crazy experiments and shit back in the day. Like, I wonder if how closely, if they looked at death and tried to see how close they could get to figuring it out. Like, because to me, that's the real disclosure.
Well,
like,
what does
the government really know about death? Have they looked into this?
Well, I would probably go even one step further. One of the things that I mentioned in Ecology of Souls is that if you look at government suppression of movements, they tend to be political or spiritual movements. The Roman Empire was very famous for doing this sort of thing. So suppression of movements and also secrecy, because those are the things that are the primary threat to authority structures, right? It's politics and spirituality. I have a hunch that that's part of the reason for the UFO secrecy, that, like, yeah, UFOs are real, and they kind of imply that, regardless of how connected they are to death, right? I realize that that's my bag right now, but like, regardless of how connected they are to death, not only do authorities realize that UFOs are real in this hypothetical scenario, they also reveal that they also realize that the implications of the UFO's reality is that consciousness is fundamental, and by extension, you can't be killed.
Yeah, it goes beyond aliens coming here to, like, dig up dirt.
Right. I mean, and that's what we can sort of table the disclosure discussion for later. But I guess the reason why that would be a threat to authority structures is because any act of resistance against the state is predicated on an escalation to violence by the state, right? You know, if you resist, or if you break the law, like, we will forcibly do something to you. And then beyond that is, you know, the threat to your a threat to your livelihood, like a threat, you know, like the end of the line for, I don't know, if you keep resisting after a traffic ticket or something, like, the end of the line is, like, we have the power to kill you. And but if we exist, then that doesn't matter. You know, if we exist beyond
beyond
death, then that
exactly.
doesn't matter.
Yes.
So it completely strips them of their power because there's
right.
nothing that
yes.
there's nothing that they can put you through. Is I guess what I'm trying to get at.
Yes,
there's nothing
yes.
that they can put you through up until the point of death
yes.
that is really going to have an actual implication for you, you know, as a being. And I think that would be a huge threat to the establishment. You know?
I mean, yeah, they talk about the alien disclosure, like that would cause, like, no, the real chaos would be if they're like, look, it turns out there's something after death. People would fucking...
Oh,
go bananas.
You'd have people. you'd have people offing themselves. You'd have
people killing other people.
Yeah. It would be madness.
Yeah.
So, and again, that might not be the reason for the UFO secrecy, but at the same time, I can say with some degree of certainty that a lot of the highly placed movers and shakers in the disclosure movement are aware of the consciousness connection and are standing by the assertion that you cannot separate the UFO from the paranormal stuff. It's all the folks that are into disclosure farther down the food chain, and I know that sounds dismissive, but I mean, like, the people who aren't bringing this stuff up to legislators and stuff, like, yeah,
yeah.
So the people who are actually involved in pushing this further are aware of the consciousness connection and have even gone on the record as saying that they think that it has some sort of connection to death and these other stranger topics. So that's why I've been saying, you know, one of the things I've been fond of saying since the hearings this past summer is that unless your disclosure is really fucking weird, it's a partial disclosure. Because it's gotta have something. There's gotta be something to this question that is not just about we're not alone in the universe. It's gotta be something about the underlying nature of reality.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Like, it's funny in a way that the public hasn't put this together yet themselves. Where, like, it would be interesting to see this opinion expressed more broadly. Where it's like, hey, wait a minute. Maybe this doesn't have to do with aliens at all. So the that's why they can't tell us, and that's why they allegedly can't figure it out. Like, it seems like no one, like, you know, the New York Times or whatever, they're putting forward this possibility.
Yeah, it's been hinted at here and there. You know, I think one of the most public sort of hints at it was one of those Corbell and Knapp interviews with Joe Rogan, where they mentioned that there has to be some sort of secret that's super disturbing or super
beyond
profound. Yeah, it has to be something profound. Like, why the secrecy, you know?
Right.
And but here's the thing, like, I know a lot of people are like, Josh is banging the drum about UFOs and death again and is, you know, railing against the ETH again, but the fact of the matter is that if you take out all of the UFO accounts, even just lights in the sky that involve telepathy or that involve some sort of communication, mental communication between the witness and the object, you're left with a substantially lesser amount of UFO encounters, you know. And again, this is not my opinion. This has been expressed by a lot of science philosophers. I can think of like three or four off the top of my head. I guess it's not a lot, but you know.
Tyson.
Well, I'm sure he would say the same thing. Is that telepathy is fundamentally opposed to materialism. It's fundamentally opposed to physicalism because physicalism and materialism says that the only thing that is real is the stuff that is measurable, the actual material. And telepathy is not that, and there's no mechanism that we can explain it. So, and then once materialism's off the table, it's like, well, these things could be anything. They really could be anything, up to and including, you know, your own imagination and your imagination made incarnate. You know, I'm not saying it's all in your head.
Yeah.
Imagination made incarnate, or any number of just really strange things. And so that's the thing that I always find funny is how you'll get these people who are like, it's just aliens, but they can also, you know, move objects with their mind. It's just aliens, but they can also, like, communicate directly into your mind. It's like, and I know that old Arthur C. Clarkeism about magic and technology, but you can flip it. You can flip it on its head, too. You know, if that's the case, then you can say any sufficiently advanced magic looks like technology.
yeah, that's true. Yeah.
That's a Jeff Kripalism, the flipping of that. But yeah, so I I'm not saying this is what it is. And I think a lot of people think that I'm really like adamant about it. I'm just saying, like, can we open up the discussion a little bit more to entertain these other ideas? You know?
Yeah.
And I'm not,
you know, like I said, the death thing is the biggest. That's the biggest mystery.
Yeah, yeah, and it was really striking. I mean, like, I did not want Ecology of Souls to be as big as it was, even one of the volumes. Like, I thought I'd be like, okay, UFOs and death, I'm going to write this and get in and out. But then the more you sort of peel back those layers, you start to find this idea of death just, like, threading its way through everything. It's you know, partially because death is somewhat synonymous with the supernatural and the paranormal. But, like, so many of our ancestors, regardless of where they were in the world, contextualize this stuff within spirits and death and the afterlife and things like that, you know, to a shocking degree. I was shocked to find this many connections, and I was like, well, if I'm going to do this, I might as well do it this way. So that's why book one, I had two options. I could either write the UFO book and constantly have these digressions, you know, of several paragraphs explaining concepts, or you can just, like, lay out all the concepts in the first volume and then really dig into UFOs in volume two. And that's what I ended up doing.
Yeah, well, it's fantastic.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Yeah, so I guess, yeah, to throw back to my crazy conspiratorial question, do you think the government ever tried to, like, figure out? They must have. I find a lot of that shit fascinating in a way. I was thinking about this when I talked to Recluse a few weeks ago. Maybe this can connect to some of what we're talking about, where it's like, you heard all the shit about remote viewing like 20 years ago, and then
yeah.
You don't hear it anymore, and it's like, look, it should be like a fundamental skill. Like, if it actually works, like, and I think maybe it probably does if you know how what you're doing with it.
It sounds like, I have a couple of thoughts on this. I feel like I might have heard that I have heard stories about the intelligence apparatus looking into the reality of a spirit world or an afterlife or something like that. I feel like those stories are associated with that Stanford Research Institute stuff. But I can't say that for certain. Yeah, it feels like I heard something in conjunction with that. But, like, there are stories that are out there about investigation into that particular topic. The remote viewing stuff, I mean, I think it does work. And you know, of course, there's no such thing as a temporary government program. Like, I'm sure that somebody somewhere is still getting taxpayer dollars to remote view something. But from everything I understand, and you'll talk to different people who were involved in that project, it worked, but it wasn't very actionable. You know, it was always like, I see an object that's, it's kind of like, what am I going to say? It's kind of like, in a lot of ways, it's kind of like premonitions in general, or like astrology. Like, it only makes sense in hindsight.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, we're going to describe to you this new frightening weapon, but we don't know it's a weapon or where it is until it is used. It's like, well, right. You know, what do we do with this? So.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's just interesting that, like, yeah, it kind of just was really tamped down in a way. It's just kind of interesting. Like, you don't, you know, you would think that it would take off more as, like, more of a thing people do, but I don't know. It just doesn't seem as popular as it was.
Well, I don't know, and I hear that I believe
like you see all these ghost people trying different shit. It's like, maybe I don't know how you could use it with ghost hunting, but it's like,
you could probably, like, you know, be like, how did this person die? Let's remote view the exact circumstances of how they died or something like that. But you know, I have heard, and I partially believe, that we are all psychic and that we all can remote view and that we all can do the out of body stuff. It just seems like so much work.
I think if you spent like 2 hours a night trying to fucking remote view, I bet you, like, within 6 months you could remote view. I mean,
if
you find someone who knows how to do it and they show you how to fucking do it and they tell you how to do it, you fucking practice for 6 months every fucking night for 2 hours, I bet you'd be awesome at remote viewing. But Somebody listening, take up this challenge.
I can't even stick with a fucking meditation app for you know what I mean? Like, I want to do it. I want to do it so bad, but, like, something always gets in the way. You know, I skip a day and I'm like, oh, well, I'll get to it, you know, tomorrow. And then tomorrow turns into next Thursday. And then it's like, well, I've reset my brain. I guess I just might as well abandon it.
Yeah, it's like going to the gym. Who has time for that? That's like a mental Yeah, it's like playing the piano. It's like if I want to learn, like I'm sure I could play piano fucking every night, but I'm not going to do that. I'm in my 40s.
That's literally, the gym was literally the analogy that I thought of. But yeah, I mean, so I, you know, I do know some people who have started using remote viewing for cryptozoology and for stuff like that. I've talked
to them. That would be
cool. You know, some of these famous sightings, they like to remote view those incidents and stuff like that, which is cool. I'm all about, like, you know, mixing this stuff up and bringing your ghost box to the woods when you look for Bigfoot and stuff like that. Like, I think there needs to be more of that, because I do think, I mean, that's where a lot of my stuff comes from, as you have alluded to, is just the unshakable sensation for me at this point that all this stuff is connected somehow.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying it is all the same thing. I personally suspect that it is all the same thing, but, like, I'm not saying that, but I am saying, you know, maybe it manifests in similar ways, or maybe it's that we, once you gain the ability to see one dimension, you can see all dimensions, or I don't know, something like that.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But there's something there. There's some sort of connection between all this stuff.
Yeah, there absolutely is. It's interesting, though, too, in a weird way, not to get too sociological, but, well, maybe it's getting better again. But when I got into this, it seemed like people were kind of yearning to work together and sort of coalesce the fields. And maybe that's the people that I continued on being friends with. But now it definitely seems like it's way more siloed off than it was at some point earlier in my now long fucking career.
So this is the perspective of a neophyte like myself. I have not been involved a fraction of the amount of time that you have, but I will say that I have this sense that I can't seem to get rid of, that, you know, I got involved in 2015 and people were talking about altered states of consciousness and people were talking about, like, really mixing it up and crossing the streams. And then that Times article comes out.
Yeah.
And boom, we're back to talking about propulsion systems and anti-gravity technology and stuff like that. It felt like things were starting to come together, and then it sort of blew apart again. Now, having said that, my assessment of the disclosure movement has warmed considerably in the past 2 years. Honestly, the past 6 months, if you want to know the truth. Because I think that they're just trying to put a fissure in the wall of secrecy. And if that's their goal, then I think it's achievable. And also the fact, you know, like I alluded to earlier, like there are people who are involved in the disclosure movement in big ways who are into the interconnectedness and the paranormal and the consciousness connection. Yeah. So my assessment of the whole disclosure thing has changed. But at the same time, man, I feel like it was a reversal of course after that New York Times article dropped on UFOs.
Yeah, I think it's got pretty tribal, and the UFO people kind of were like, "All right, see you later, assholes. We don't want anything with your Bigfoot shit and your ghosts and stuff."
Yeah, and meanwhile, you've got folks like, you know, folks that they look up to, like Colm Kelleher, who are saying, no, this is all connected. You know, I just saw an interview with George Knapp saying, no, like, you can't separate the supernatural from the UFO. And they're like, okay, but it's just little green men little scientists. Little scientists.
It's the single-minded obsession. Like, I think I don't know when my mind changed, but I kind of, like, have this sort of begrudging respect for the whole thing, where it's just like, these fuckers just won't give up. Like, all right, I kind of like you now. I you know, you annoyed me. Now
you pushed past that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The joke has gone so far that now I'm laughing again. So, yeah, it's like, so I begrudgingly respect their passion and shit. But, yeah, it seems like it's just so single fucking minded that it's just like, they just want the government to say aliens are real. That's all they fucking want. Like, it's just so basic.
But then
that opens Pandora's box of
it does. It opens the box that we were talking about earlier. Like, you know, the fact that, like,
because then people are going to try and figure this out.
none of this reality means anything, because it's not what we thought it is. So, you know, that's a Pandora's box. But I also get dismayed at how incurious I see a lot of the UFO community. UFO fandom, I guess I would say.
UAP community. They're the UAP community.
Yeah, I mean, so I saw a social...
All them, who they are. They're the UAP community.
I saw a social media post a while back that was like, you know, well, if near-death experiences look like UFO experiences, then why don't we see more aliens and NDEs? And I'm like, okay, back that up. Number one...
It's like they probably are on some...
I have collected stories of greys in near-death experiences.
Right.
Number two... there are plenty of stories of light beings, which are a staple of near-death experiences, that appear in UFO contact. Like the Free Study, again, one of the largest studies of experiencers, I think from like 60 countries, and I think it was like something like 1,800 applicants. There were suggestions from that study that light beings might be the most common form of UFO contact. Entity, UFO occupant. And then number three, people vastly underestimate the number of UFO stories that involve beings that just look like people. You know, I mean, that's something that Micah Hanks mentioned this past August at a conference that we were just at, that, you know, a lot of these, especially historically, but even to this day, like there are a lot of stories where people go aboard craft and it's just people. And of course, if it's just people, well, just people show up in NDEs all the time. So I say all that to say that, like, it's this problematic environment where people feel like they're the first ones making these observations, or like, you know, it's that thing of like, guys, did you hear that UFOs can shut down nukes? And it's
yes,
like,
yeah,
like this was discussed like, you know, 20 or 30 years ago.
Right,
and it's a problem that I see even among some of the more prominent people who are getting UFO attention. They're saying things like, you know, oh my goodness, you know, UFOs might be an expression of animism. And I'm like, did you not, like, before you get up there and make these statements, did you not read anything that Thomas Bullard wrote? You know, did you not read again, like, I think that the people who are coming into this field, like, you got to roll up your sleeves and you got to not only read the books, but you've also got to wade into the muck of tabloids. You know, you've got to go to those sort of, you've got to go to people that you probably wouldn't think of reputable as today. You've got to read Tim Green Beckley, and you've got to read Jim Moseley, and you've got to like really like see what has been said before you try to say something that you think is new.
Right, right. And what's interesting is where they're saying something that's not new, it suggests that they don't have anyone in their circle of not just what they're researching or investigating or reading or whatever, but even in their circle of contacts that would be like what you just said, that was like, oh man, that's an interesting point, but you want to read this guy's book first, because like that actually, it's already been done. Simpsons did it. Like that. This whole right. thing is Simpsons did it. Like,
well, and then it begs the question of like, why are these people being platformed? Why are they rising to prominence quickly without really seeming to have done the literature review? You know, is there some sort of hidden hand that's elevating them to be a spokesperson for the phenomenon? You know, you wonder. I'm not saying that is the case, but it makes you wonder. You know.
Yeah, someone definitely wants this boosted, but it's also become sort of like a snowball rolling downhill, where it's self-perpetuating in a way, too.
Yeah.
Like UFOs have leaped into another layer. They're like fucking Marvel movies now. They're like, they're okay to talk about. It's okay for you to fucking be interested in.
Oh, man.
You can... You know, you can be a UFO buff now, and it's cool as being like, look, this is gonna sound like gatekeeping, but fuck you, it's Paul Giamatti. Paul Giamatti. So he can have me on. So I'm like looking and reading. You know, I swim in the paranormal news cycle every fucking day. So I see Paul Giamatti. You know, he's nominated for an Oscar, and his real passion, Kutch, is his paranormal podcast.
Yeah.
Where he talks to celebrities about paranormal stories. And it's like,
that's
cool and shit. And it's just like, oh man. Like,
and I'm sure he's read Cynthia Hind and Rosemary Ellen Guiley and Hans Holzer. Like, I'm sure he's done all that. Like, it does get gatekeepy after a while, but at the same time, it's just like, if you're really invested in seeing this move forward, like, let's not just rehash stuff that we've talked about. Like, let's try the pop culturation.
I'll invent that word if it isn't a word. But so yeah, the pop culturation of UFOs it's kind of led to a lot of this stuff lifting up in a way, which is good, I suppose. But at the same time, it's odd.
Well, yeah. The pop culturization thing is weird because, like, you know, I often like see people who have bumper stickers of the Mandalorian, and they're the same people who would have like beat me up in high school for knowing the word Mandalorian. You know, it's the conquest of the nerds and the geeks, I guess. It's part of what we're seeing across all culture with the, you know, broad acceptance of Star Wars, which is about as geeky as football now, and the Marvel movies, and, you know, and now UFOs, which, you know, we're the fringe of the fringe, you know, for the longest time. Well,
so yeah, I think, but there is, I think there was some reason why this broke through. Like, obviously the New York Times article fucking, but it was like, right, some kind of dam broke. If people want to talk about disclosure, that was it, but it wasn't like what you thought it was going to be. Like, it was like, okay, now it's okay to talk about this shit. Good luck. We're not telling you anything. We're not telling you anything else, but now we don't care if you talk about it.
Yeah, and it's the Michael Pollan problem. You know, Michael Pollan, acclaimed journalist who wrote that a book, I believe it was called How to Change Your Mind, that took the world by storm in 2018 and made it okay to talk about psychedelics. And in the meantime, there's, like, you know, millennia of indigenous traditions that have talked about the benefits of psychedelics. But, oh no, this, you know, this white journalist from the, who used to work for the New York Times, has given us permission to talk about it at our cocktail parties. So now we're going to actually, you know, engage with it. It's super irritating. But, you know, I guess that's just what happens. You know?
Yeah. I mean, it brings more people into the tent, I suppose. So.
But it speaks to that thing that you've always said, which is, like, you know, the UFO disclosure crowd sometimes cheers for its own demise. Like, as soon as the UFO is revealed, like, they're not going to any of us. Like, they're not talking to any of us. They're talking to Neil deGrasse Tyson. They're talking to Michio Kaku. Those are the people that are going to be on television, you know. And, you know, they'll sort of stand on the shoulders of
the
Kiels and the Hynek's and the Friedman's.
And on the other side, you have, like, the Harvard guy. You know, he's so it's like, yeah, the old days of sort of the traveling circus ufology is, like, done, I think, or it's dying out now.
Yeah, and it's
sad because I do love it. I think I said earlier before we go, like, the carnivals and circuses and festivals and the, you know, it's interesting. It's turning with Bigfoot, you see it, and UFOs too. It is sort of becoming the part of, like, a localized cultural folkloric thing now, right. It's interesting, but at the same time, sort of the old timey fucking everyone's gonna, you know, the St. Louis Radisson fucking in the middle of May, you're gonna be able to see, you know, 12 of the world's most captivating flying saucer researchers,
right? And
days are pretty much kind of over,
and this is where I start sounding like I'm navel gazing, but I think that the UFO becomes something different at that point. You know, I think that the UFO, again, I'm sounding like, you know, I'm sniffing my own farts over here and getting all academic, but, like, I think that the UFO is sensationalism, and it is being on the margins, and it is sort of residing in this sort of seedy basement of a Radisson conference, you know, like that's what the UFO is. It's not this glossy,
it's naughty
thing packaged for mass consumption. Yeah, it's kind of naughty. You know, I remember as a kid, you know, one of the main reasons that I read Bigfoot books was because I go to the library and, like, picking out a UFO book felt like I might as well have been pulling a Hustler off the shelf.
Yeah, it was like subversive.
Know? Yeah, it was just something that was just kind of just an icky feeling that I couldn't shake. Now, obviously, I love UFOs now, and, like, I'm totally into it, but, like, that was sort of the cultural milieu, I guess, that it existed in, and like, so I think that, like, once you start pinning it down and it's like processed food, right? You know, it's it becomes something like that.
But it is, it seems, there's been a rehashing, a revisiting of this stuff where local communities are embracing it, which is good. Like I said, part of the folklore, especially Bigfoot. I find that a lot. Like, these towns are like, oh, we're the Bigfoot capital of whatever and shit, and we're going to hold an annual festival and everything. It's like, well, that's pretty cool. So as communities do it more, that's good, because it
there are a lot of those popping off, and I think it's important for the same reasons that I like to buy local. You know, it's all about, you know,
yes,
supporting your community, supporting the uniqueness of certain areas. You know,
the only downside is the only downside is if they have vendors, there's always like maybe like 15 to 20% are the soap, and the other like 20% are like homemade jewelry, and it's like, I don't have any use for
I've got my Bureau of Paranormal Research and Defense wood burning wooden plaque that you gave me over here on the wall. Like, that's the kind of stuff that I want. Like, I want UFO encrypted tchotchkes, you know.
Yes, I want fucking Bigfoot paintings or whatever. Yes,
or the stained glass Bigfoot that I got in Sutton. That's sitting in my kitchen. Yeah, I mean, that's what you want. But yeah, it's always kind of that's kind of a small price to pay for seeing this take off.
It's kind of one of the more amazing.
And I kind of wonder if, like, look, it's rough out there. Like, it's a rough time to be on this planet.
That's for sure.
I mean, don't get me wrong. Like, we don't. It's not the Oregon Trail, right? You know what I mean? Right. But in terms of like instability and in terms of being unsure about what the future holds, like, it's one of the most unstable times I think we've seen in 150 years or whatever, in the West, at least, again. So a part of me wonders if the reason that you're seeing this interest in the paranormal, this acceptance of the paranormal, is because people are confronting things like death and, like, you know, the end of time and falls of civilizations. Like, they're actually having to stare that in the face, and they're like, it upends the predictability of reality enough that you're allowed to entertain things like UFOs. So I'm not sure that if it wasn't for the geopolitical instability of the moment, if we would even be talking about UAP.
Yeah. It's like a humanity wide existential crisis is like unfolding right now.
We know the
planet's dying. There's like tumult, geopolitical tumult. There's domestic tumult. There was just a pandemic. It's like, I need a few just really quiet years here.
Yeah. And I don't think we're going to get that. But that's very much in line with, like, you know, George P. Hansen's Trickster in the Paranormal, which is talking about how these things thrive in that sort of unstable liminal zone and all that stuff. I mean, I know it sounds really heady and academic, but it's Hansen's work, I think, has borne itself out numerous times to be pretty consistent. If you bet on that interpretation of the phenomenon, it usually seems to pay off.
Yeah. Yeah,
which is why I'm interested to see where all the disclosure talk lands, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I was kind of, when I turned the corner, I was like begrudgingly respecting them in the summer when they had the big hearings, and I was like, well, them fuckers are pushing that alien like right to the finish line here. Like, we're getting closer and closer to, like, they're really, but then, you know, this report comes out last week, and it's like, yeah, we didn't find any evidence for aliens. Or you're it's like, I, you know, I have a myriad of thoughts.
But the faith in every one of our institutions has been so undermined at this point. It's not going to matter. Like, you know, you could have. Here's what I had a panel at DragonCon again last year, because anyway, August was a very busy month. And one of the things that I said, I said, think about the person that you didn't vote for in the last presidential election. Now imagine that they are president, and now imagine that they're telling you that aliens are real. Do you believe them? You know what I mean? And
right,
it's like, there's no way. I really, you know, regardless of what's said, half the, at least here in the U.S., half the country is going to say it's real. Half the country is going to say it's fake. You know?
Yes, bizarre.
It's like, well, it's like you said, the pandemic was the alien. That's one of those. That's super insightful. Yeah.
Yeah, the pandemic was the alien invasion. We saw what people did. Like, they took sides and the country split down, you know, I don't know necessarily what the percentages were, but certainly, even if one side was bigger than the other, the little side seemed louder. But I suppose it depends on what side you're on. But anyway, so, again, it's like, what did people fucking expect? Like, the thing is, just the whole thing, when you really take a step back and, like, look at what happened, like, they were ordered to go look in the archives to figure out if there was some evidence some fucking smoking gun document that fucking there was a picture of an alien. like what did people really expect?
Right.
Like, they're not gonna fucking, it's not gonna be like buried on page 38 of a report. Like, it's just, to me, that was like the funny part, where it was it's just standard operating procedure. Well, here, you're not gonna get it in that fucking form.
And for an institution to even say that there is evidence of extraterrestrials, I do sympathize with the extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence bit. Like, I think that, like, you can't take that lightly, you know, coming from an official mouthpiece. You know, it's one thing to, which is another thing that I've thought a lot about, is that, like, I think that disclosure is individual. I really do. I mean, it's,
absolutely.
You have to convince, you have to look into stuff and read and research, and maybe have your own personal experience, and like you have to convince yourself, and like it doesn't need to be a proclamation from on high. Like, it needs to come to you. You need to find your own way to that conclusion that this stuff is real in some sense, you know?
Yeah. Well, I don't know who the hell I was talking to on the show, but it's, people need to kind of, if you really want to get into this UFO stuff, if you're in the UAP crowd, you're probably not listening to the show anyway, but like, get, step out of that thing and just go on your own and try and figure, stop bothering the government about it. They're not going to, like, I don't necessarily think you're going to get what you're looking for in the form of the aliens. Like, as you said, they can crack the secrecy of something. I mean, maybe that could be an interesting development, but it's not going to come in the form of the alien thing.
Well, and this is what the UFO has been doing, right? It's been, if I could propose a level of meta-positioned control over reality / the narrative, the UFO is changing the tenor of conversation at the societal level, but it realizes that that's not enough. It also has to have this grassroots movement as well at the individual level, and that wouldn't be enough on its own either. So I see these two things as kind of coming together, but that just reinforces the fact that disclosure is going to be on the terms of the phenomenon and not on the terms of anybody down here, you know?
Yeah. Well, in a way, it's kind of, I see it also as sort of a challenge to these UAP folks, where it's like, look, the government says they don't have anything. Show me the fucking aliens. Like, it goes back to this. Like, if you say, if all you have are stories, like the government said, we looked at your stories, they don't. So you got to step up your game, like UAP. Like, you need to step up your game. Like, we need, like, crystal clear footage of a fucking UFO or actual alien or some kind of something tangible.
I really think you should sell bumper stickers of "Show me the fucking alien."
I'm getting, like, close.
I would totally. Well, I mean, because that's the only that's the only thing that would matter. That's the only thing that would tip the balance, if anything would. Again,
that's
back,
like,
to back to our original points. Yeah.
And it's good to tie it to the paranormal in a way. It's also, I think, that people, the expectation that this is going to unfold in the narrative way that people seem to are pushing for, betrays the very essence of this phenomenon and the paranormal. It's going to happen when you least expect it. It's going to happen on its terms. It's going to happen like it's just going to fucking do what it wants to do, and you can't wrangle it.
Not if you've never read a UFO book. You know what I mean? And that comes back to that's why I'm not sure if the old guard of ufology is cynical or if they just have a better grasp on the way that this thing has always played out and the sort of cat owner with a laser pointer that the phenomenon
Right.
seems to be, it is in complete control of what happens. And I know that some people will say you're introducing God through the back door or something with this discussion, but that's just what it's if you look at this if you look at what happens, that's what always seems to be going on. Every experience fizzles out in this inconclusive, hey, maybe it happened, maybe it didn't. Here's some physical evidence, but there are also holes in the story over here. Like every
Right.
it always sort of ends that way. And I've been comparing it lately to if you've ever tried to pick up a watermelon seed,
Yeah,
you like grab it, and the more pressure you put on it, the more likely it is to just go bing and fly across the room. And yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what happens. The thing that I'm concerned about is being fed a tidy version, a tidy explanation of what's going on that isn't what's going on.
Yeah.
I'm concerned about that version of disclosure that is not fucking weird. That
Right.
people will say, oh, okay, well, this is what's been going on. And then you try to convince them otherwise, and they're like, but no, they said this. And it's like, well,
Right. That was what I was wondering with this report. Like, is this going to turn into, I don't think it's going to have the cultural impact of the Condon report that kind of like killed ufology to the public, killed UFOs to the public for a long time. I think people are just already set their ways. They just believe that the government's covering it up. So they're just like, yeah, okay, well, I don't think it's going to really change anyone's fucking mind.
But it is that dichotomy of when they say there aren't aliens, I don't believe them. When they say that there are aliens, I do believe them. Even
Right,
though
yeah.
It could come from the exact same person, not even the same
Yes, they would have
organization, but the
believed them.
same
Yes, if the
person.
report said there was aliens, they would have fucking believed it.
Yeah.
So it's yeah.
Yeah. And I guess that's just sort of consistent with the shortcomings of critical thinking that we have at this juncture in our existence. People just don't examine, they don't interrogate their own biases anymore. If they ever did. I mean, I can't say that they ever did, but I feel like it has gotten worse where people, confirmation bias is a real thing.
Yeah, and a real lot people have lack of self-awareness, I find all the time. I see people posting on social media. I'm like, did you think before you fucking, posted
Yeah.
that? Or even just hanging out with people, it's like, Jesus Christ, this
And
guy.
and we all do it. Like I do
Right? Of
it,
course, yes.
But at the same time, try to sit back and perceive the irony of your closely held positions. And it's that old Terrence McKenna quote, if it's real, it can handle the pressure. So
I like that.
if your narrative has to reconcile all data points, or there's something wrong with it,
Yeah,
Interest, inter,
I
interest. It, I will say it's interesting.
would
I will say that this has gone farther than I thought it would. If you were compiling a list of top 10 disclosure seasons, because it is seasonal, if you were to compile a list of top 10 disclosure seasons, I dare say that this would be in the top three. You know what I mean? Like
Yeah.
it's an interesting time, but cautious optimism, I think, is the prescription,
Yeah,
with an emphasis on
yeah.
the cautious. Yeah.
So I'm going to pivot to something else now. Have you gone on ghost hunts? Like, what have you, check me on one of your ghost hunts. Not like literally, but like, have you used the equipment and shit?
I've been on a few. I'm not a big fan of equipment. I think that the best, well, number one, I think that the phenomenon is about interacting with human beings and not
Yeah.
necessarily interacting with silica and chips and stuff.
Yeah.
Number two, I value more eyes and ears. Now, having said that, you kind of have to run cameras and you kind of have to run recorders because that's just what you do, and there's a chance that you might get something great. I would default to the position that Tim Renner has mentioned in the past, which is we have permission to get audio, but we don't have permission to get video of these things. Like, there's some great audio out there. There's some great Bigfoot audio. There's some great EVP ghost audio. Not a ton of great UFO audio, but the photographs are always like, maybe that's not, maybe that is, you know. So like I guess I would say like use the equipment, but don't make it the sole focus of what you're
Center,
doing. My most dramatic UFO, sorry, UFO, not UFO. I've had zero UFO stuff. My most dramatic ghost experience was in 2007 or 2008. I went to Waverly Hills Sanitarium. With I was it was it was I've always had an interest in this stuff, but I was dating a lovely lady
So a
who
long time ago then. This was like
long time,
15,
yeah,
16 years ago, yeah.
I was like 22.
Wow.
I'd met this young lady in grad school, and she was very much into she had a group of friends up in the Ohio area who were ghost hunters. So we drove from Athens, Georgia, all the way up to Louisville, and met up with her friends, and we had the whole place to ourselves, a team of about probably 10 or 15 people max. And I had a couple things happen. So I went in, you know, I was a big fan of Hellboy, so I went in with a Hellboy attitude, like, yeah, come here, you stinking ghost dude. I'm gonna
Nice.
come out and show me, you know, I gotta
Yeah.
get back and have a drink, you know. And I think that's part of the reason why I had such a strong showing that night.
Yeah.
Because I did have some interesting things happen. There are three things that I would say were the biggest takeaways. The first thing was what kind of like broke the ice for me, right? It was the thing where I'm like, okay, this stuff is actually real, because I always thought it was real, but like you don't think you're gonna actually see
Yeah.
anything. And the first thing was, if you're familiar with Waverly, it's shaped like a big, wide open U. You know, like we're
Okay,
talking
yeah.
about like, you know, maybe like straight line of rooms and then like 45 degree angle
Okay.
wings on either side. And on one of the floors, I can't remember which floor, I've probably said or mentioned it in the past, but on one of the floors, there was this phenomenon that would happen where you would be approaching the corner of one of those U's, and it looked like someone had set up an old tube television on the other side. You know, that sort of blue
Oh,
glow that's
weird.
flicker, you know, that blue glow. That,
Yeah.
if you're watching someone who is watching an old TV, there's like a blue glow on their face. You know what I mean? And it was like that playing against the ceiling and the floor and the walls. And then you'd turn the corner and there'd be nothing there.
Oh, weird.
That happened about twice. I confirmed later with some other folks who were there that they had seen something similar. The other thing that happened was on the fourth floor. Now, on the fourth floor of Waverly, there is an entity that is reportedly called the Crawler or something to that effect. And
Oh, God.
well, this is fascinating to me because guess what's on the fourth floor of Trans-Allegheny? The
Crawler.
Crawler.
Oh,
Yeah.
weird.
Because it's this thing that like, you know, runs up at you, like scuttles up at you on all fours on along the floor, and then it goes like, you know, on the walls and then onto the
Oh,
ceiling.
yeah.
And that's exactly what they described when we went to Trans-Allegheny 2 years ago, if you remember.
Weird.
So I don't know what that means, fourth floor crawlers. I think it implies an archetypal nature to these things, but
Yeah.
that's another discussion. But I wasn't aware of this at the time. I don't believe that my girlfriend was either. And I was again doing my Hellboy routine. And I was like, you know, I was sort of lollygagging as we walked down the corridors, and she runs up to me and she describes that. It wasn't until later that I heard that that was something that people saw on the fourth floor. I'm like,
Yeah.
okay, well, that's an additional confirmation for me. But I was really downplaying what she had seen. I'm like, I bet it was nothing. I'm trying to be big and bad.
Yeah.
And I get within a couple of feet of this door to one of the stairwells. There's multiple stairwells throughout the whole thing, and each of them is closed by a really heavy metallic door, thick metallic door,
Yeah.
not going to swing open on its own or anything like that. I am feet from this metallic door, and it slams open By which I mean it was like someone had like karate kicked it from the other side.
Yeah.
It went from completely closed in an instant to being so open that it hit the wall behind it. Jeez. Bam.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Big metal door scared the absolute shit
out
of me.
Yeah, that was terrifying.
I went from Hellboy to Shaggy and Scooby in like a second, you know. And that was my you can't get the toothpaste back in the tube moment. That was my moment where it's like, okay, this stuff is real. The other thing that I don't talk about too much when I talk about my Waverly stories, because it's not always fit for public consumption, but this has been all of America, right?
Yeah, of course.
I would go to the kitchen and it would feel like someone had just kicked me in the crotch. That gut feeling, God. And I didn't really know what it was until I mentioned it to someone else, another gentleman in the group, and he was like, "Oh, that happened to you too?" Because he claimed to have had the exact same feeling. So
weird.
I distinctly remember, crawling out of Waverly, with the sun coming up over Louisville, and getting smudged in the parking lot. And just being like, what do I do with this? And then, going back to my girlfriend's friend's house where we were staying, and like laying there in bed with the dawn coming through the window, I can still picture it. I'm like staring at the ceiling and I'm like, this stuff is real. Like, without passing any judgment on what it is.
Moment, yeah.
Yeah. It really is that moment where like, this is what it seems to be. So yeah, and ever since then, it's been diminishing returns. But
it got you in, yeah. Now it's got to go squeeze other people and wake them up to it.
I did see. My dad was a big Civil War buff, and we went to Lexington, Virginia, and we went to a house that was used as a hospital, as so many houses were in the Civil War, and. This is my only other like really noteworthy, super noteworthy ghost thing. Yeah. And the stairway was so narrow, like one person at a time. Like there's no way you could do two people at a time up there. So single file. That meant that the group that was coming down would stay on the top floor while the group that was going up.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And then the group that was coming up would come up, and the group that was waiting would come on down. At least that was the way it was for us, and that seemed to be sort of what the policy was. And I get to the top of the top floor, and in the middle of this crowd of this tour group is this maybe 14, 15 year old boy, sunken cheeks, staring right at me, wearing a gray uniform.
Okay.
And he's just looking at me. He's a little bit taller than most of the other people on the tour. But like, I thought he was a cosplayer or a reenactor,
Yeah,
like
it was part of the show. Yeah,
because like that's not an unheard of thing. You maybe not see him inside, but you'd see people wearing that sort of thing. And I mentioned to my mom, I said, that kid was really into it, wasn't he? And mom's like, who? What? I'm like the kid in the uniform. She didn't see it. Nobody else in my family saw it. I was an undergrad at this time, so I guess it was maybe technically before my Waverly experience. But nobody else on the tour had seen it. And I talked to the ticket takers or the ticket givers.
They were like, "Oh, you saw Jedediah."
No, they didn't say that, but they did say that there had been nobody who'd come through there that day in a uniform, and it was like a bottleneck. Like you had to, in order to gain entry to the property, you had to pass through this one.
Yeah, they noticed like someone wearing.
Yeah, or like he changed up there, like he brought in a backpack and he changed up there. So like no.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's still some ambiguity there as to whether or not it is what I think I saw, but that's something else that I've noticed. And I don't know how many experiences you've had, Tim, but
not very many.
The ones that I have had, I will always talk myself out of,
Yeah.
It's like
yeah,
you start always... like the years pass and you're like, is that really what I saw? Maybe it was just this.
Yeah, it could have been something else. Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, you got to try to like put a pin in that moment right after it happens and try to remember that. And that's the only way that you can keep yourself from talking yourself out of it, in my experience.
Yeah, just as cheesy as it sounds, like just cherish the memory, I guess. I was a bit laughing to myself because I had almost that experience in a way when we were at the Bellwitch Cave, only because, like, for folks who've never been, it's like run by some family, and there were just little kids like running around, part of the family. I don't know if you remember this, when the girl like gave the presentation at the house, there was like a couple of little kids kind of like
yeah, it's literally a mom and pop thing.
Yeah, like, yeah. And I'm like, are these kids real? Or are they like, are they, am I seeing like there's supposed to be little kids running around in here? So yeah, that was an interesting time, that Bellwitch Cave.
I would love to have some time alone in there. That'd be fun.
Yes, absolutely. I would. They would never let you do it, but I'd like to like spend the night in the Bellwitch Cave, like,
yeah,
in the front part. That part further in where they had the eagle wings, that part gave me the creeps. But the
get in there and turn off all the lights. Jeez.
Yeah. It's an odd little place. What surprised me about the Bellwitch story was that it was almost completely unrelated to the cave. It was like, wait a minute, this is, you're kind of, you're mushing these two stories together here.
Yeah, but it does speak to, you know, the idea of like a window area or something like that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And it also speaks to egregores and myth making and all that stuff. I mean, that's the thing, is like, I don't know if there ever was anything to it, but that cave has been egregorized to hell and back, you know?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And so it's entirely possible, probable, that stuff happens there.
Yeah, it's an incredibly eerie location, like, just going in there and shit. It's, yeah, it's wild.
Yeah, I bet it's completely different in the daytime.
Yeah, but you're still in the dark inside the cave.
Yeah, I guess it looks the same inside the cave, yeah. But now, I will say that in the Bellwitch Cave, I was convinced that someone from the tour group had gone on ahead of us, because I was hearing voices from that back chamber. And then I mentioned it to the tour guide, and he's like, yeah, that happens all the time. So maybe that was a thing. I don't know.
Yeah. Could have been an echo, though. Who the fuck knows?
Well, it could have very much been an echo. I mean, it's, yeah. And plus, you're primed, you know, for there to be something strange, and, you know.
Plus, you never know. The dude, he might, when he talk, you know, he might know the very right spot to stand at. Like, he's like, yeah, if somebody stands right there, you can hear, you know. He's like, yeah. I'm in here. I eat my lunch in here.
I live in here, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
See, that would be the people I'd love to talk to. Just be like, okay, dude, what are the weirdest shit you've seen, man? Like, you know.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. It's like, I have a sense, and obviously I haven't done a giant survey or anything, and you will hear stories of employees who haven't seen a thing, but I have a sense that, like, most people at places like that, I would even say most people at any sort of historical location,
yeah,
have had something strange happen to them. You know?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it happens, yeah. So I had you for a while here before we started the show. It's 11 o'clock now. I want to talk to you afterwards. So we'll,
all right.
We'll wind down the evening here. So obviously you're in the midst of this massive project here for the NDE course, which people can find at cosmosinstitute.org. I had to get it up by my nose. Cosmos with a K, cosmosinstitute.org. So obviously, what's next for you? It must be, you know, you're in this thing now till Memorial Day. So it's like,
yeah. My schedule is pretty full. Even though I've planned all the classes out, I still want to, you know, refresh them and tweak them the week before, and, you know.
Oh God, yeah. I'd be the same kind of, where it'd be like, I'm just locked in.
It's taking up a lot of mental bandwidth. I would venture a guess that like the teaching of the course is the easy part versus the preparation. Who knows? But like even if that is the case, it still is like something else to keep in my brain. But I have a couple of projects lined up. One of them is a joint project with Barbara Fisher, who edited my last two books, and I, you know, absolutely adore Barbara. And so we're doing a project together. I'm not entirely sure how much I'm supposed to say about the subject matter, but it's a topic that is just, it's like drinking through, it's not even like drinking through a hose. It's like drinking through Niagara Falls. like just
Oh,
in
wow.
terms of like just the amount of data that we're going to have to crunch. But we're starting to make some headway on that. I also picked out a topic for my next solo book. But heaven knows when I'm going to get around to that.
Oh
You know,
boy.
it's
Yeah.
so and then you know, I had two more ideas for future books come up. So I've got plans for the next couple of years.
And then you
You
never
know.
know. You might get an idea for another fiction book and be like, I'm gonna do this instead for a
Yeah,
while.
I really enjoyed writing the novel. It is simultaneously harder and easier, you know, because you're not scrambling to get quotes right, and you're not scrambling to get your sources, you know, lined up in
Yeah.
your in notes and stuff. But at the same time, like you're staring at that blinking cursor, and like, and it's got to come from you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Although a lot of it doesn't come from you, a lot of it just comes seems to come out of nowhere. But anyway, so yeah, I've got a couple ideas for that too. It's just a matter of, you know, finding the time in between everything else. I am still writing YouTube scripts for the channel What Lurks
Yes.
Beneath. Yep.
Yes. What lurks beneath?
Yep. I not every video is one of my scripts, but every other video to every third video is something that I've written. And I don't have enough kind things to say about the guy who runs that channel. He's a wonderful human being. Best boss I've ever had. And so
Ah,
but
there you go.
that keeps me busy because
What lurks
it's
beneath?
yeah, it's that alone is 10,000 words a week.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, but luckily I write really fast, as you can as you can tell from my output. So and you know, a lot of this
And what
too
are the
is,
topics are I've known you do this for a long time.
oh my goodness.
I just can't consume
No, you're good. No,
paranormal media. It's
it well,
like
yeah. No, I totally get it. And you know, what I always try to do is slip in some medicine with that spoonful of sugar, you know. So
Right, no, I guess what I'm wondering is what topics do you cover through this What Lurks Beneath?
not a lot of UFO stuff. The UFO stuff doesn't seem as popular on that channel
Yeah.
for whatever reason.
But
It's
like
most
specific cases and like of different things, different stories, like
Yeah,
that kind of
I
thing.
mean, like so the best stuff is the stuff that's a single case that you just do over the course of an episode. So
Yeah. Like the
you
Outlaw
know,
Files.
or the Hexham Heads, you know, that's another one that we did. But it's, you know, it's all about that kind of thing. It's all about, I would say that there's probably like an eldritch undercurrent to a lot of this stuff. It's all about like, you know, the deep, dark, supernatural powers. And, you
Gotcha,
know,
yeah.
and it's very much geared towards being frightening. You know, I source all my stuff. Like, I know that there are a lot of YouTube channels that use AI to generate stories
Oh, God.
and straight up make up stuff. Like, there are those, but I source everything that's in my scripts. And you know, a lot of cryptid stuff. My boss has a real soft spot, as do I, for like really rare cryptids, like the one-offs and
Yes.
stuff. Like the
Yeah.
have you ever heard the story about this hairy octopus, the hairy land octopus?
I think a couple of guys were driving like in Brazil or something they saw it.
It was in Spain,
Okay.
and they come across this like hairy octopus
Yeah, Nate
in the
Brisley wrote
car.
about it for Good Old
yeah
America. Yeah.
yeah
Wait,
so it's
no, he wrote about it for Coast to Coast. Nate
okay.
Brisley wrote about it for Coast to Coast.
Yeah, so like stuff like that is like is also really it goes
That's
over
a
really well.
cool case, yeah.
Yeah, and so you know, and what's so great about this is that he lets me pitch different ideas, and he has yet to say no to any of my pitches.
Yeah.
And he's also assigned me some stuff, but he has yet to say no about any of my pit to any of my pitches. And you know, sometimes it's something that it's an aspect of the paranormal that I myself have neglected, and so I'll push myself and be like, I need to learn about so and so. I know that there's enough
Yeah.
material here, and so I get the chance to, you know, have basically
Yes.
a funded deep dive into this particular topic or this particular case. So
Yeah, that's kind of what I was alluding to in a sense, or when I asked you that, because I see a similarity with my job too, where it's like I learned so much shit that I never would have learned just about different cryptids all over the world, or like old stories and legends and like that. It's like it's like they pop up in the news, and then I'm like, well, I need to learn everything about this legend
yeah,
or
I mean,
thing.
100%. Well, one of my favorite things to do is to there are a couple of different books that I have. I have a book on curses, and there's some, like, you know, there's some chapters in there that I've always found really interesting, but I've never actually sat down and read and, like, learned the narrative of how things unfolded. So sometimes I'll be like, can I write about this curse or this, you know, this particular chapter?
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, sure. So I actually, like, get to read about it and do some research for it.
Yeah,
and
it's fun. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's really been an incredible opportunity, and I feel really blessed to have that in my life. So between the YouTube gig and this teaching gig for the next couple of months and other book projects, and then trying to be a functional human being and have a family and play gigs still. You know, wedding season is coming up, so I'm getting busier with gigs too. I have no minutes to spare. Yeah.
Well, that's good. That's good.
Hey, I think being busy is better than being bored, honestly.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yep, absolutely. All right. So you're going to be busy pretty much all year. So that's good. That's good. And folks can find out more at joshuacutchin.com. That's obviously your website there. And of course, and folks, this is coming out. This episode's coming out Wednesday, the 20th. So this thing's going to start in like a few days. Now's the time to sign up for it. And it's at cosmosinstitute.org.
Yep, cosmosinstitute.org. That's Cosmos with a K. And I'm really looking forward to having that opportunity.
Awesome.
And joshuacutchin.com, as you said, is the place to find out where I'm going to be next and what I'm working on and what I've just come out with. So
yeah, all your projects.
Your one-stop shop. Yep.
Cutchin there. And get the books and, you know, that's it, man. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really do appreciate it. It's funny. Like we talk all the time, but I don't.
Right.
It was like awkward at the beginning where I'm just like, okay, now we're performing. Now we're doing a, now people are listening to us talk.
So right. No, no, this was great. And, you know, I did kind of feel that way too at first. It's like, oh, it's like we're having a bunch of people listening to a phone call, but
we
fell into our stride for sure.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, man. I'll see you later this year. I know. And, you know, we're in touch all the time. So, I will fix my issues and have you on the show more often. So,
Tim, you will never fix your issues. I'm sorry.
There you go.